and welcome to Start Your Week from the Bunker. It's Monday the 15th of April and I'm Alex Andreu. With me this morning, casting an eye on the week ahead, is our own Hannah Fern. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Alex.
Hannah, given events, we have to reverse our usual order and start with international affairs this morning. After Iran's drone attack on Israel, the world held its collective breath for a moment. The damage was pretty minimal, but the intention was very hostile. So how has the situation developed as we record on Monday morning?
Yeah, so, I mean, as we record is pertinent because it is changing hour by hour. But overnight, the UN General Secretary Antonio Guterres says that the situation is on the brink. He used those terms when meeting the Security Council. And it does certainly feel that way. And I think it's important to remember that it was obviously the first time there'd been a direct attack on Israeli soil from Iran. So it is a crucial moment in the region. Israel has said that it will respond, and the quote is, in the manner and at the time of our choosing. It doesn't rule out another strike, and it certainly doesn't suggest de-escalation either. But the US has been clear that the exchange is a sort of tit for tat, so it has already said it won't provide military support for any further Israeli action at this point. So it's trying to dampen down things. So that's where we are this morning.
Hannah, as you said, there are a lot of people saying that Iran's attack is a response for Israel's drone attack on the Iranian consulate in Syria, which means this sort of completes a cycle and Israel should not respond. But will that fly with Netanyahu? Isn't his agenda quite different here?
Yes, I mean, this is the thing. Benny Gantz has already said that Israel will exact a price for the attack. So it doesn't feel like there is a closure within the administration, within Israel. So there's no sense of this de-escalation and an appetite for de-escalation within Israel, despite efforts from the wider global community to see it as this closed event. So what happens next is crucial, I think.
Was this a smart move by Iran, diplomatically speaking? Because both Western governments and his own war cabinet partners seem to be losing patience with Netanyahu. And at that exact point, won't this kind of reunite them?
It definitely does seem to have achieved that sense of reunification. The language that's being used, I mean, first of all, there will be listeners, I'm sure, who were surprised to find that we were directly involved. We were obviously one of a number of Israeli allied countries to help put out this attack and to intercept the missiles. Now, Biden has described its support for Israel as ironclad. Sunak has said that in the UK, will continue to stand up for Israel's security. So that sense of losing patience with Netanyahu and turning a bit of a cold shoulder against the escalating rhetoric there has definitely died down because, allies have to be seen to be there at this time of an attack directly on Israeli soil. So one of the interesting things is that what happens in terms of Netanyahu's popularity in Israel itself among Israeli citizens might be an interesting factor in this. There were Israelis who were really starting to lose their patience with him, and especially without the return of the hostages who are still in Gaza, that frustrated at his failure to actually achieve that aim. So it does feel as if like it could also put out that line of antagonism within Israel as well. So, yeah, perhaps a poor choice of timing for Iran, but nevertheless, it does feel like a very febrile time in the region.
Yeah, it feels like both sides sort of need a forever war that bubbles along but doesn't hugely escalate, which is a really dangerous thing to aim for because the potential for mistake or miscalculation is just huge all the time. Mm. At the same time, won't this have emphasized the US and UK's value to Israel as allies? Wouldn't that have boosted their seat at the table, as it were, by, proving that if an attack like this is launched, Israel does very much need help in fending it off? Military experts are showing this would have been a very different situation without the help of those US and UK assets.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think it does really crystallize the commitment of those, that group of partners of which we're one. And I suppose in that sense, that does strengthen Israel as well, because it has demonstrated that despite the constant discussion about what's going on in Gaza at the moment and the, you know, the voices that are being heard all over the world about concerns about that, that when it comes to it, when there's a military event, the US is there, the UK is there, other European nations are there. So it definitely strengthens that group, I suppose, on the world stage.
What happens next, Hannah? Obviously not with the military situation, which, you know, Israel has said they will retaliate in some way, although they haven't said when and how. But are there any diplomatic efforts afoot to start a little bit of a dialogue in this situation, or nothing yet?
The only thing that's clear at the moment is Biden really sort of emphasizing his position that this must be an end to the US's involvement in a military action. Well, we do know that that is all words, that should it actually come to it, should there be some, you know, escalation that resulted in constant tit for tat, the US would be there. So it is rhetoric rather than reality. And I think that's why it feels such a troubling time.
More terrible news on Saturday. Tragically, Sydney joined the growing list of cities traumatized by a sort of senseless mass attack. What do we know about the assailant and his motives at this stage?
So the assailant was a 40-year-old man who'd recently arrived in New South Wales, was originally from Brisbane, and he was called Joel Couchy. This is a white Australian man, a surfer with a known interest in firearms. He'd been known to Queensland police for some time too, but he'd never been charged with anything. He was living a kind of a very hand-to-mouth life, living in his car, and had been known to struggle with his mental health in a very serious way since his teens. The really important thing is that he was not so far found to be motivated by any particular ideology. And that is why it's not being described as terrorism. This was just a man who's incredibly troubled, and unfortunately it's resulted in this horrific attack. Online, there's a lot of chat and misinformation. First of all, still linking the attack to terrorism when it isn't. And secondly, there's this discussion that pops up every now and then saying that why aren't we calling it terror just because he's white? Now, I think this is really important one to flag up, because it's not being called terror because it isn't terrorism. Terrorism is a particular term that we use to describe an action that is motivated by a political ideology. And this is not. This is sadly just a senseless attack motivated by who knows what, a very, very troubled man.
I mean, that both makes the situation feel slightly safer because it doesn't feel like part of a whole, but also slightly less safe because it is so random, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
And a friend of mine is in Sydney at the moment, and she was telling me how small a place it is and how you could hear the choppers everywhere, and, you know, the panic was very palpable in the air. It's not like London. It's quite a small, compact city.
Mm.
How will something like this have affected the Sydney residents, I guess?
I mean, as you say, these are the things that we can never predict, plan for, or really prevent, because ultimately, if somebody, you know, has a severe mental health crisis, you can't plan for those things. But I mean, I would hope that while I completely understand what you're saying about the kind of sense of like that palpable fear that you know there's this major event going on, actually, some of the stories that have come out of it in terms of the way the community rallied to support one another as the attack was happening are really kind of warm, heartwarming, I suppose, in terms of the way communities just support each other. From the lone police officer who ran in on her own and took the most difficult decision that she had to take to sadly end the assailant's life in that, you know, terrifying situation with no backup, but also the two young men who saved the life of a 9-month-old baby who was injured when sadly the mother of the child was too injured to look after it anymore, and she died trying to protect her child. But two young men managed to stop the bleeding, get the baby to safety to a paramedic, and the baby has now survived. And these are the stories, I think, that remind you that, you know, when these awful things happen, actually, people are always there for each other. So that's what we take from it, I think.
Now, Hannah, in Ukraine, the government is reporting that Russia is making gains in the east. And the situation there is becoming quite desperate, especially with ammunition, which is now rationed. David Cameron tried to bring the GOP on board in his recent US visit. Has there been any impact? Has there been any movement?
Not really, unfortunately. So Cameron has taken over Boris Johnson, I guess, in taking the global lead on support for Ukraine, which seems to be waning a bit as the war drags on. And as you say, Ukraine's fortunes worsen a little. So this trip to the US was designed to sort of solidify that support. While he was there, he warned Blinken that a failure to support Ukraine at this crucial point would basically amount to appeasement of Russia. But a really important thing, when he was over there, he failed to secure a personal meeting with the Republican Speaker Mike Johnson, who has really played quite a significant role in the battle in Congress over aid for Ukraine. And so that meeting that he was hoping for didn't happen. And it really feels like he hasn't had the success of his predecessor, which feels weird, I think, at home for us, given he's much the better communicator over Johnson. And yet he's obviously not managed to win the argument. He also had a really important meeting with Trump, which, I mean, depressingly, that feels more crucial than ever now, doesn't it? And apparently he failed to change Trump's mind also over this. So Trump is very much feeling that the US has done what it can in terms of aid and shouldn't be committing any further. And given how significant Trump may be again in the next coming years in America, that doesn't feel great either for Ukraine. So he hasn't had the success he'd hoped.
On to domestic affairs. Parliament is back this week, and there are quite a lot of tricky points coming up for Sunak in the next few days and weeks. First of all, the Rand bill is possibly nearing the finish line.
How many times have we said that over the last year?
I don't know. Do the Lords look like they're digging in for ping pong, or is it likely to go through? Because the noises I'm hearing sound a little bit like the Lords are ready to give up.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. So it is a crucial week that we'll either see it probably actually watered down in some way or amended. The Lords have sent 7 amendments back to the Commons, all of which are likely to be rejected. Whether or not there's going to be then a little bit of a ping pong, which is, you know, sending another 2 amendments back and then accepting it, or whether there's a digging in is the key issue. There's a good piece, I think it was in The Observer, by Lord Simon McDonnellan over the weekend, which I would suggest going to have a look at. He is a crossbench peer, former Foreign Office Secretary, in which he basically is challenging his fellow Lords to resubmit the same amendments, which would require the government to either force them to accept them or possibly even lose the bill. And he thinks the legislation is high enough stakes to do that. So I do think it will be a really interesting week. And I think the Lords are actually in the mood for a bit of a fight over this.
The Criminal Justice Bill also contains quite a lot of provisions that have upset both opposition and Tory backbenches, especially around measures that seek essentially to criminalise sleeping rough. Are we likely to see a rebellion on this?
I would say less of a rebellion, a little bit of a backlash. So on rough sleeping, there are 10 Tories who have been quite aggressive in their amendments over the rough sleeping sections, who are concerned that it would lead to people being criminalised just, for things as spurious as having a strong smell while being on the street. I mean, really, really grotesque, personal, and like just immoral stuff. So some Conservatives have come out and wanted to fight what they see as an immoral piece of legislation there. And on the decriminalisation of abortion, on the flip side, you've got people like Miriam Cates, who, you know, really want to use this to highlight divisions within the party and to egg on that kind of internal culture war that the Conservatives are already fighting, having not even lost the election yet. So I don't think there'll be a rebellion that destroys it, but it will seek to expose the splits, I suppose, in the party, which is not good for Sunak at this time.
And there are also 2 bills in your specialist area. One is the renters' rights bill, and the other one is the leasehold reform bill. Some say that they've been watered down to basically being useless. What do you think?
I think that's probably quite fair on the leasehold bill. There's very little left of it that campaigners initially wanted. So there's no replacement of leasehold with common hold. There's no cancellation of forfeiture, which is where you can lose your home entirely over failing to pay service charge bills if you're a leaseholder. It only really bans leaseholds on new houses, and it does include some useful things like new rights for longer leases and the right to buy a freehold on your leasehold house, which is, it's bonkers that leasehold even exists on individual houses anyway. But it's very much not what it was designed to do when it was first hoped that there would be a significant reform. It's not what Gove intended. It's not what campaigners wanted. So Labour also initially said that they would actually go much further and get rid of leasehold entirely, replace it with commonhold within the first 100 days of a Labour government. And they've already backed down on that. Now, I'm not surprised they backed down on that because it's not possible. That was a promise they made that was never, ever going to be possible. But the mood around people campaigning for this change is a bit damp at the moment. Everyone feels a bit depressed. On the renters reform bill, now this is interesting. There has been a huge backlash to the changes that have been made. These changes include giving extra time, really, for lots of change. So insisting on there being a review of the court system before the Section 21 no-fault evictions are removed to ensure that any evictions that need to come through can actually be progressed properly. And also a review of local authority licensing schemes before they're introduced for landlords. And these are being seen as something that's been pushed through by backbench landlords who are frustrated with the bill. Actually, I don't share the kind of concern that some campaigners do about these changes. If you actually look at what real landlords, I'm not talking about people sitting on the back benches, but you know, if you look at landlord forums online and what they're saying, none of them are happy about this. This isn't a win for landlords. They're not really excited that they've basically got their way. The provisions will come in eventually. It's just going to take a little bit longer. And I think with Labour coming in, who are incredibly committed to these changes, I think a lot of it will be forced through. So I think there's less reason to be concerned about that one.
Finally, there is the cigar ban.
This is my favourite story of the week.
I know, because it's such a weird flashpoint, because Johnson has basically shot his mouth off about it. Is this a test for whether Johnson still wields any power in the backbenches?
I mean, it is possibly in a very silly, funny way. So Johnson's using the image of Churchill and his famous cigar to campaign on what, I mean, Churchill, Johnson's favourite person, obviously, as we well know, to campaign on what he obviously considers the entire smoking legislation that Sunak has constructed to be one of the most unconservative pieces of policy that he's ever seen in his lifetime. He's furious about this. He thinks it's, I think the word he's used is nuts and bonkers and so on. But the thing is, Johnson is out of step with the general public, who actually do want to see smoking phased out in this way and really don't care about this. They're perfectly happy with it. But again, it's the party again. Who's with Johnson? Who can be bothered to stand up? This idea that Johnson thinks that the image of Churchill is the right one to win a modern legislative debate on is so depressing, but funny as well.
Now, on the Rayner affair, Hannah, I think it's a non-story. Those are my feelings. On its substance, it's nonsense. But what does it reveal about the power of Conservative headquarters and campaigning tabloids like the Mail to bully the police and manufacture stuff like this?
Yeah, so I mean, I definitely think it says more about the tabloid culture that we still have in this country than anything else. And I agree with you, it's probably a non-story. It does show that the tabloids still have this ability to generate and lead a story. And I think this is really interesting, it runs both ways. I think that we'll find when we get closer to the election and when they have to come out and take their sides, you might find that there's much more on Sunak that at the moment isn't being explored. So I think that, you know, it happens both ways. We can't pretend this is only the right-wing press bullying the left, because it will flip when we've had a massive election victory.
Just a few more things to touch on very, very briefly. There's been some further revelations by the BBC on the honey trap story. What's the new information that we know now?
We know that the honey trapper first popped up actually last year at the Liberal Democrat conference in Bournemouth, of all places, where despite some decent tech digging, I suppose, finding that user on Grindr was in fact located in North London at the time, they attempted to claim that they were at the conference and started messaging gay members of the conference. And basically, a group of people who were there all worked out between them that they'd all been targeted at that same time. So it was had started a bit of a campaign at that point to try and get gossip, basically, it seems. More recently, there'd been a suggestion in some of the reporting around this that it could actually be a hostile state who was the honey trapper here. But actually, those people who were involved in the very first attacks felt that it was basically just probably a tabloid journalist seeking information or political gossip stories. So it has changed the focus a little bit on who or what is doing this and why.
And the last thing to mention is that we have found out, thanks to some dogged work by Pippa Crerar at The Guardian, that the Michelle Donnellan legal bill is double what we first thought. Yeah. I mean,
I find
how has she not resigned?
I don't know. And why has nobody asked her to? That's the bit I find weird.
It is a straight-up resignation matter, and I just do not understand how there is no more traction
to this story. How it can be possible that she hasn't been forced to resign. Because if I libel somebody as a journalist and I break the social media policy of my organization I'm working for, I'm on my own. that's a communications job. I do not understand how I'm with you. It's baffling beyond belief.
Yeah, it is baffling. And interestingly, it does seem to have cut through. So even though actually the media don't seem to be concentrating on it, I hear about the story from a lot of people who are not into politics. So it's a fascinating one. Right, final thing. Have you been reading bits and pieces of Liz Truss's hotly anticipated new book, 6 weeks to Bugger the Economy, or whatever it's called? Anything catch your eye?
Oh, some of the excerpts are brilliant. There's two things that really jumped out at me. One that really irritated me, but also gave you real insight into her mind, and one that I could really, I can definitely sympathize with. So the first one is, she said that she's really disappointed in the lack of support around being PM, i.e. that she had to make her own hair appointments, which apparently she was disgusted by. And this is my favourite. She had to get her diary secretary, she said, to go out and get her cough medicine in the night because there was no health support for the PM. There was no one to go and get her cough medicine in the night. Well, hello. Welcome to the real world. If I get a cough in the middle of the night, I have to wait till 7:30 a.m. to go out and buy my cough medicine. So should you. And secondly, why is she getting her diary secretary out of bed just to get some cough medicine? That, I mean, she's a grown woman. That's phenomenal. The other one was like, oh, the Queen dies, and my first thought was, why me? Why now? Now, the interesting thing about this is it started a big debate on Twitter, particularly among people on the, like, journalists on the right, about, was that an understandable, you know, people saying, oh, well, that's not the thing I'd think. You know, if you're in this privileged position, what a thing to think. My thought was, that's exactly what I'd think. That is exactly how I'd feel, which incidentally is exactly why, and I'm very self-aware about this, I'm totally unsuited to high office. And the fact that she has absolutely no self-awareness about the fact that that isn't the kind of thing you ought to be thinking. Yeah. Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. And brilliant. To think they made a biopic about that Gandhi fellow when there's a story like this that hasn't been told. And that's it from Start Your Week Today. Thank you, Hannah.
Thank you.
If you get value from our work, then you can and should support our work for as little as £3 a month on the funding platform Patreon. You'll help us keep making this podcast and get many benefits too, like a shout out on Monday's show. And here is Hannah with today's.
Thank you to David Hughes, Paul Millington, and Tricia Scott.
And thanks to all of you for listening to Start Your Week. The Bunker will be back with you tomorrow.
Start Your Week from The Bunker was written and presented by Alex Andreu with Hannah Fern. The producer was Liam Tate, and the audio producer was me, Jade Bailey. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, and the group editor is Andrew Harrison. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by Jim Parrott, Start Your Week from The Bunker is a Podmasters production.